BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to the Best of Today podcast on BBC Sounds. I'm Amol Rajan. I just wonder if you've ever thought about writing a brief autobiography, a life report, if you like, reflecting on your earthly sojourn. A lot of people think about doing something like this when confronted with a terrible diagnosis or whilst watching a relative die. A lot of people leave it too late. Such life reports can offer an opportunity for reflection, maybe a bit of self-appraisal and the sharing of wisdom which might benefit the young. We asked for your life reports because we were sparked by and motivated and inspired, frankly, by an initiative from the Hospice Biographers. They are recording the lives of people living in hospices. And so we asked the Today programme's listeners to get in touch with us with their life story, and we rather ludicrously asked for them to do so in 400 words. It's a good discipline, you see, asking people to write lots in a short space of time. And get in touch, you most certainly did. Thank you so much to all of you who wrote in. We're genuinely humbled by the amazing response. We were totally inundated and we couldn't hear from everyone, so we chose a selection of those touching, sometimes funny, sometimes revealing, but pretty much always poignant life stories. Life is very often not linear, and it's those twists and turns that Nicola Hill wrote about in her 400 words.
I've married a man once and a woman twice. I was untimely ripped from my mother's womb after 24 hours of hard labour, an emergency caesarean just before Christmas Eve in 1966, a good year for football. My head was too big, apparently. I have an MA in Creative and Life Writing from Goldsmiths College and a BSc in Social Psychology from LSE. I travelled to South America on my own, aged 21, to learn Spanish, and I met an Australian. We trekked together through Colombia and fell in love. I followed him to Sydney and we married. At the age of 28, I came out and met my first girlfriend, an academic from the Bahamas. 6 months later, I fell in love with Laura, and we've been together for the last 27 years, having a civil partnership, followed by a marriage when they both became legal. There have been many legal and attitudinal changes towards homosexuality in my lifetime, from not even hearing the word lesbian, let alone knowing of any when I was a child, to the wonderful visibility we enjoy today. Newsreaders, actors, politicians, who have all come out of the closet. The next generation, hopefully, don't even know what that phrase means. Career-wise, I worked for Cancer Research UK, RNIB, and NCVO in fundraising and publications. I joined The Guardian for a couple of years to help set up the online version of Society. For over 20 years, I have run my own editorial services company. I've also had 3 non-fiction books published and offer training in life writing. Laura and I set up a website to promote gay-friendly wedding venues and won an award for a startup business. It was very successful to begin with, when people wanted to be assured of a welcoming venue for their big day. Now, thankfully, people assume venues will want their business, and if they don't, more fool them. In 2010, Laura and I decided to foster 2 children long-term. We were approved within 9 months, and a brother and sister came to live with us, aged 7 and 11. It was the biggest challenge of our lives, and still can be. They're now both adults and starting to make their way in the world, one as a teacher and the other in catering. One of them sent us a Mother's Day card saying, "Everyone should have 2 mums."
The relationships that we form during our lifetimes can be challenging, and that can sometimes come down to one incident, one single moment in time. Michelle Taylor was very candid about the relationship that she had with her mother.
I can see her now. My mother, still alive by the way, same age as the Queen, sitting in a red and gold armchair in our 1970s council house and just saying no. But why? No. Again, I asked why. Zed came the final reply. Why Zed? Get it? And then you knew you would get nowhere. So I stuck my tongue out at her. That's all. No expletives, no ranting. Just the childish response of a frustrated 13-year-old to an equally childish response from my mother to my request for a birthday tea. All I wanted was a few sandwiches and a bit of Victoria's sponge with my two posh friends from school. I'd been to my posh friend's house and done exactly that and thought how wonderful this was, with garden flowers on the table and those pink wafer biscuits. So, could I have it too? No. She'd said Zed, and with that, she refused to speak one word to me for the next 6 years. I was in all the top sets, considered to be reasonably clever, despite coming from the rough council estate, got all A's in my report that year. Apart from games, I was never that great at games. But it all changed that day. I became a drifter, staying at friends' houses whenever I could. Christmases and birthdays came and went. I have no memory of them. I would cook myself terrible food, those dried ready meals. I blame them for my cellulite today. Silence for 6 years. I did scrape a degree, became a teacher, then a head teacher, and eventually sold my house and bought my very own school. I've had 4 proposals, but never married or had children. I was terrified my mother's pernicious ways would run through me to my child and live on. I have a dog. But the school gave me my children. I was determined that no child should go unheard, unnoticed, unseen. It was a huge success. I ran it for 15 years, selling it last year following a breast cancer diagnosis at 56. I still see my children, children no longer, of course, but still a joy. As for my mother, I haven't told her about the cancer. I bought her a house, nothing grand, but it's hers. She'll probably outlive me. I visit as rarely as I can.
Ken Cooper's mother also shaped his whole being. In his 400 words, he mused on a decision that she had made that affected his whole life. And that was the reason that he was actually called Ken.
What's in a name? Richard. Please call him Richard. It was the name of Marlene's boyfriend. Marlene was a 20-something who had befriended my 32-year-old mother and who had asked to help at my birth. This would be my mother's 4th, so it should have been straightforward, despite taking place at home, a post-war prefab. Marlene saved my life. My umbilical cord had wrapped itself around my neck. The nuchal cord problem is well known in medical circles, but my mother and Marlene managed to realise what was going on only at the last minute, and not before I had turned black. Given Marlene's part in the successful outcome, you'd think my mother would have granted her request, but Richard was relegated to second place. She named me Kenneth Richard. Kenneth? Whence Kenneth? My father's name was James, but sometimes I heard him called Ken by my uncles and aunts, for example, and even by Mum occasionally. My mother explained, Ken is short not for Kenneth, but kennel. As a toddler, Dad was fond of hiding in the dog kennel, so he acquired the nickname Kennel over time, shortened to Ken. So possibly Kenneth came from my dad's nickname. Not that anyone called me by my full name, not even when admonishing me as parents do. No, it was Kenny. Always Kenny. Ugh, Kenny has such an unreliable wide boy feel to it. Kenny Lynch, Kenny Everett, Kenny Ball. And Kenneth is a bit of a mouthful, I've always thought. A bit formal, a bit, well, Scottish. As soon as I left school, I became Ken. You know where you are with a Ken.
In 400 words, Monica managed to reflect on lust, love, and the huge role that genetics played in her life.
Apprehension surrounded my arrival. Would I be a boy? Would I have haemophilia like my uncle? Relief for my exhausted 36-year-old mum. I was a girl. As a toddler, I announced I would like to have 4 little boys when I grew up, but was told, as a carrier of the disease, that would not be a good idea. I knew about genetics before it became a separate science. The structure of DNA was announced when I was 10. I delighted in playing on the allotment which my mother carefully tended to give us kale with our Sunday lunch. I sowed seeds, grew beans and peas. My childhood rhythms were predictable and unchanging, with weekly Sunday school and stimulating choir practices for me and my father. There were occasional excitements, with short trips to find and pick primroses, cowslips, blackberries and sloes. A pass in the 11 plus took me to a new world with a free place at a brilliant public school. My eyes opened to unimagined possibilities. At university, I discovered lust and love and made lifelong friends. Bored by zoology, dissecting the same bony fish week after week, I switched to physiology. My scientific policy work was fun. Every day. It was my life. Never dull. My passion for medical research enthused some government ministers to invest in it. I was honoured to get a CBE, but my parents were no longer alive to share it. 4 years in Paris was interrupted by rectal cancer. It runs in another part of the family. I found I had marvellous friends to support me. I was left with a colostomy, but I've happily carried on regardless for over 25 years. I was born with a wanderlust. I started exploring on my own, then had a husband who could drive, I can't, and after we parted, I continued, mostly alone, making friends everywhere. In lockdown, I could answer truthfully that I always had someone I could phone to alleviate the loneliness of living alone, as I had done for 30 years. But I can't help wondering why I never found a soulmate. With a huge circle of friends, many from decades of choral singing, lovely godchildren and their families, I have a family of sorts. But genetics influenced my choice to have no children of my own.
Regret was something that featured in some of our story writers, and Janet Gray's heartfelt 400 words were sparked and triggered, in fact, by a moment of household rearranging.
Sorting through a pile of old photos, I came across a picture of my younger self. She looked so beautiful, innocent and smiling. The young man by her side, unsmiling. His arm clasped around her waist in a territorially tight hold. She marries him soon after. She didn't know that within a month he would become her tormentor and abuser. My middle-aged self longs to warn her and offer her advice to help her reduce the pain and distress I know she will feel in the coming decades. I would tell her that she doesn't always have to be good. She can break some rules. The rules would not always be imposed for her benefit, rather as a tool to keep her controlled. She can speak before she's spoken to be heard, not just seen. Be comfortable in asking for what she wants. Believe that she has the right to ask, even if the answer is no. Learn to say no, for this also is her right. To ignore the pressure placed upon her from others to look and act in a particular way. Though her body may not be the perfect body she sees in magazines, it is wonderful, healthy, and every part beautiful because it's part of her. Value it and it will serve her well. To not hold back on life, things she might want to do but is fearful of doing, what is the worst thing that might happen? Take risks. It's pointless waiting for all anxieties and fears to go, they never will. Rather accept that it is possible to do things while still feeling anxious. She will never be more fearless than she is now. To learn to relax. She will never please everyone. And that's not because of any failing or flaw in her. Rather that everyone's expectations are different. So it would be impossible to know what is going to please everyone. That the mess she's compelled to clean today will be back tomorrow. And even though she believes she will be judged unless she's perfect, people will judge her no matter. To understand she is not to blame for her husband's cruelty. Nothing she can do or say will justify his behaviour towards her. He is not her responsibility. Don't stay silent for so long. I slowly place the photo back in the drawer with a sigh filled with regret.
Julia Cheeseman's relationship was something that she wanted to celebrate, and the chance meeting that led to a lifelong love affair.
It was the summer break after my first year at Bath Academy of Art in 1973. I was hoping to spend it with my friends, but my father insisted I go to Spain with him and my mother. So reluctantly, I went. My parents had found an English bar and were telling the owner how I'd been pestered by Spanish boys in a local disco. He said, "My son is on leave from the Merchant Navy. He'll take care of her." I didn't realise that it would be for the next 38 years. 6 months after that meeting in Spain, Graham and I were married by special licence at St Giles in the Fields on a wet, cold February morning. And by evening, we're heading down the Thames on a cargo ship, spending the next year at sea on a slow trip to New Guinea and back via Venezuela, Panama, USA, Australia, and the Pacific Islands. We were relaxing in hammocks on deck, listening to the surf, when he dropped the bombshell. He said he really wanted to return to the UK and become a policeman. Another unexpected turn in my life. So that was the next 30 years for him. His new life seemed interesting and exciting. So I became a police radio operator. And that was the next 25 years for me. A life I never could have imagined. Long hours in the control room when nothing happens, then frantic hours at the scene of an incident or in a gold control, the Silverstone Grand Prix, Princess Diana's funeral. It gave me a huge sense of doing something worthwhile. My wonderful life partner died 10 years ago after retiring. I'm so thankful for that meeting in Spain that completely changed the direction my life would take. These last 10 years have sometimes been a struggle, but I've got some wonderful friends and I've returned to my art, doing printmaking course and photography. When it all gets a bit much, I've got a head full of incredible memories I can escape into.
Some of the love affairs we heard about weren't as straightforward as Julia's, though. Deborah Marshall reflected on her life, loves, and a regret.
When I was 5 or maybe 6, I tried to kill myself. Not in any serious way, I have to say. Not involving anything as dangerous as knives or guns or poison. No, instead I ran some water in the bathroom sink and put my head into it. Oh, when I say head, I mean face. And not for long. I got the sleeves of my jumper wet in the process and I had a row from my mother. The very mother whose scolding had prompted me to try to end it all in the first place. So it's surprising that despite this early attempt at ending me, I should have survived me for nearly 60 years. And in that 60 years, I've done many things I wish I hadn't. Not that I regret those things, because what's the point in that? But I just wish I'd been better, somehow. Here are some of those things. When I was single, having affairs with married men. When I was married, having an affair with a married man, despite being married to a very nice man whose heart I broke. There's an upside here, as I later married one of the married men I had an affair with as a single woman. Getting drunk one New Year's Eve in the bar of the Algonquin Hotel in New York to celebrate my divorce from the very nice man whose heart I broke. Again, an upside here, as I later got married in the Algonquin Hotel to very nice man number 2. We found the vicar on the internet and I'm not really sure if we're legally married. Going to Alaska after watching a Storyville programme on BBC Two about it and contacting the man who appeared in the programme, who was intrigued by my interest and, it appears, me, and sent me the money for the flight. And then actually going to Alaska despite being married to the really nice man and having young children. Yes, that's a long sentence, but how else do you tell this mad story? But despite all this, there is just one thing that I regret. And it is a regret, like all true regrets, that I've never voiced, but which is, nonetheless, a constant inner chiding. The day before my father died, I went to see him in hospital. My father was asleep, ill, dying. I leaned over him and said hello, and suddenly he reached out his arms, eyes still closed, and grabbed my hands and pulled me to him. And I pulled away.
Our plea for 400 words resonated with Brian Daly, who was celebrating a recent significant birthday.
Last Friday was my birthday. I am now 85. This was my first birthday as a widower. My beloved wife died in August last year. Life has been good to me and continues to be good. Luck has played a part. I was not killed in the war. Born a Cockney in Stratford, London, I survived the Blitz and was evacuated to middle-class Middlesex. There my luck persisted. I went to a very good state primary school and was one of the around 50 pupils in my class, yes, 50, who passed the 11 plus to attend a grammar school. I suppose I was also lucky to have been born quite bright. But luck is not the only key to having a rewarding and relatively problem-free life. You have to fight for it. My parents were poor. We never had a phone or a TV. My mother had a tin for the rent and another for the gas and another for electricity and still another for the insurance man. We went to church, but God didn't provide. It was an ongoing struggle. My personal fight to have a better life than theirs began in earnest at 16, when they made me leave school to make a contribution to family finance, and they're also being unaware of the advantages of education. Then it was three nights a week at evening classes to keep up with my peers who had remained at school. Then came national service in the RAF, being taught to speak Mandarin with some exceptionally bright, well-educated fellow servicemen whose influence encouraged me in the quest to achieve some success in life. And so in due course, I got into the University of Reading, where I met my future wife and graduated after 4 years, having received a full grant, paid no fees, and left owing no money, unlike the very unfortunate present-day intake of students. By 1963, I was married and a lecturer myself at what became first Portsmouth Polytechnic and later Portsmouth University. We had three children who maintain they had a happy childhood, are individually successful, and now have an extra job of helping to care for their widowed dad. Of course, I wish that my wife was still alive, but I am fortunate to be happy in my old age. I get out, have got some good friends, and have to now do the garden by myself, despite the physical pain. I spend quite a lot of time playing bridge. Sometimes I win and sometimes I lose. But unlike life, it's only a game.
Kate Elliott's life story feels like there might be another 400 words to come.
Born in the Middlelands, feeling middle-ish throughout life, resenting it a bit and not appreciating the sacrifice of parents to provide the best life possible. Childhood seemed idyllic. It was what I knew. A family, a garden, safe spaces to play with local friends on bikes, with pets, lots of sunshine and silly hair, bunches with cherry bands, freedom. Yet a strong surround of church and activities to create routines and patterns which scaffolded us and kept us safe. Friday night drives into the countryside, stop at a pub, sister and I in the car with a packet of crisps whilst parents had a quick drink. Buying farm vegetables, peas in pods that we'd shell into a colander for Sunday lunch. Potatoes dug from the garden, mint to chop and mix with malt vinegar and sugar, strawberries and raspberries, seasonal and exciting. It was what I knew and what we did. We never really discussed much. Dad had mental health issues. Anything for a quiet life. We never upset our mother. She'd had her own traumas and we wanted her to be okay. We were never an affectionate family. It's how we were. It's what I knew. But we did love each other and still do, past and present. I see my mother in my every day. the most significant influence in my life, for better and for worse. Growing up gay in a time of concealment, playing the games of life that didn't always suit, keeping stuff to myself so as not to upset Mum. Another friend presented, never a lover. I've struggled with love. No one quite like my mum. Middle achiever, yet the first in the family to graduate. Teacher and coach, loving helping others to grow. A middle life, but not insignificant in its impact. Inspiring a love of reading, theatre, communicating, self. And now a voice and an advocate for vulnerable children. Did I say I'd adopted two children? 13 years ago. Tough yet rewarding. One about to go to university. Did I say I'd lost a leg to cancer? Life-changing and ultimately life-affirming, reminding me of what I live for and prompting me to put missing bits back into my life. Fitness, creativity, spirituality. I appreciate the good stuff in my life and the tough stuff, for it helps me to grow. I think that's why I'm here, to grow, to help others to grow.
And finally, let's close with Adrienne Leijstam's 400 Words, a life story that began with a surprise camping trip to a farm with a secret.
It was an unusual childhood experience. My reserved ancient parents joined a nudist camp. The farm, as it was discreetly named, to disguise from possible inquisitions, was magical, and running around naked was completely natural. Every weekend I would sit in the back seat of my father's Austin 7 as we rattled our way from the suburbs of Birmingham to the farm and parked in the warmth of the stony square farmyard littered with strands of sheep wool. We walked across a steeply sloping field laden with bags and provisions for a 2-day stay. At the far side of the field was a small gate into a thick wood, my gate to freedom and discovery. I was walking into an Arthur Ransom book, and my love of the countryside has never left me. School years were marked by struggles, crushes, and fleeting first romances. Then it was out into big city life in London, working on local newspapers. When the sweaty confinement began to choke me, I escaped to a remote fruit-picking farm in Norfolk, where I could breathe again. Under a gooseberry bush, one hot sunny day, I met Andish, a young Swede with gorgeous blue eyes and stunning brown loafers. Much to my surprise, a holiday romance turned into a 50-year partnership, chasing our dream to become farmers. We had little money or farming experience, but plenty of drive and practical skills. Working into the nights, we renovated tumble-down properties, first a remote semi on a mountain, and then a Welsh longhouse with 10 acres. Colourful local characters urged us on our journey into the livestock world. We kept turkeys, chickens, geese, horses and calves, and bred Welsh cobs for the show ring. We found little money in the muck of farming, so to maintain our lifestyle with two daughters in tow, Andish kept his job with British Gas, and I freelanced between animal duties. When money ran out, we moved on to another ruin to renovate in the hope of finally accruing enough to buy a real farm. We trained horses for carriage driving and ran a horse-drawn hire wedding business for 10 years. When the recession hit in 2000, bookings declined dramatically, money ran out, and we had to move on. A tumble-down French chateau or a Welsh castle were excitedly considered, yet our best gamble yet lay just 3 miles from our current home. The sale of a hidden historic 17th century deer park with 80 acres was whispered by a friend. Its ancient turf and hidden valleys where deer and calves roamed was untouched by modern farming. We fell in love again. It took 2 years of tense negotiation to buy, but kindly guided by its cheerful pork pie-hatted owner, we learnt everything about managing deer. We were real farmers at last.
Thank you so much for listening to the Best of Today podcast on BBC Sounds. We've hugely enjoyed reading all of the life stories that we've received, and we're so humbled by your immense response. Thank you so much. Hope you too enjoyed hearing those reflections, the wisdom, and also the adventures.